ask if you must talk during this meeting, take it outside. Tonight, our speaker is Ken.
Wow.
Okay, if you'd like.
I'm Ken. Can you hear me? Okay, I'm Ken Cross. I'm an alcoholic. I also did a little cocaine in my lifetime. I didn't expect to start talking now. I have to kill a lot of time. I have a friend here, Brendan, who just moved from L.A., who's sitting right there, the really tall, good-looking young guy. He just came up to me and goes, man, this is one of the wildest meetings I've ever been to in my life. And in a good way, you know, with enthusiasm and excitement. This is the way CA was back in 1983 when I got sober. You know, people being a service. We didn't have who's an addict to call out during. And we didn't call out during anything because our sponsors would kick our ass if we did. But that was then and this is now. And it's good to be back here. I haven't spoken here in about 8 years, I think, something like that. I've been coming to Phoenix almost yearly and giving talks since about 1984, when CA kind of first started got going over here with Mark and Alan and some other folks who kind of first put this thing together for you. My sobriety date's February 3rd, 1983. So this year I celebrated 21 years of sobriety. And I want to stress, free from all mind-altering substances. All mind-altering substances. And it's funny because I hear now that there's this thing going around CA where people are starting to complain that CA should have singleness of purpose and should only be open for the cocaine addict. You know, that if you're not a cocaine addict, you shouldn't be able to identify from the podium. And, you know, I was at the meeting where we took the format from AA and we rewrote the format at Denny's in Hollywood one night. And we specifically put in the words, all other mind-altering substances, because AA wouldn't let us in the room. And we wanted to know that if somebody came in with a glue problem, that they could come in and they would be welcomed, whether they were sniffing. You know, whether they were sniffing Carbona or gasoline or cocaine, you know? I mean, you got to realize I got sober pre-crack and a little bit of freebase was still going on. And, you know, I came in during the power and glory years where cocaine was attorneys, rock stars, and groupies. So meetings were really interesting back in L.A. in those days, you know? And, you know, and for me, my entire sobriety has been a gift. You know, an absolute gift. Because I'm not one of these guys who woke up one morning with a really bad hangover and said, you know, maybe I ought to go check into Crossroads today and change my life, you know. When I got sober, I was living in a stolen Volkswagen Rabbit that I had stolen out of Tucson where I did my last geographic. I had some stolen money from a bad coke deal. It wasn't a bad coke deal. It was a coke deal that never happened because I stole the money. And I went back to L.A. because it was the only other place I knew where I could go or maybe I could do something or have some kind of a life, you know? And, you know, my family wanted nothing to do with me. My sister swore she would spit on my grave. I had no friends left. I had burnt every bridge. My life in Tucson at the time revolved around me getting a front of a gram or two, going to Jack in the Box at 4 in the afternoon and buying the biggest, gnarliest hamburger and eating it so that it would like sit in my stomach like a brick. And then I would go hustle at the bars that I used to hang out with, and I knew all the bartenders, and I tried to sell a couple of grams and, you know, steal a few lines out of it and drink for free. And that was my life almost every single day, you know. And then where I was living, they finally asked me to leave. And so when I headed back to L.A., you know, what was in that Volkswagen Rabbit was it. That was my life, you know. I'm 6'6", and my life had been condensed down to the front seat of a Volkswagen Rabbit. And that's where I slept at night, so you don't roll over much, you know? And I would take that car up into the canyons in L.A., and I would park it, and I would put towels in the window so that if anybody came by and wanted to see who was in this car, I could, like, have a second to get my act together, because I was so ashamed and humiliated, you know, about where my life had gone. And for newcomers, you know, we talk about living life one day at a time. I don't know about you guys, but when I was in my last month of using, my life was down to about 1 hour at a time, because I had nowhere to go. Nobody wanted anything to do with me. You know, I would wake up in the morning, I would go down to the 7-Eleven, I'd buy one of those 7-Eleven sticky muffins that are about the size of a grapefruit. I'd buy a big cup of coffee and a newspaper, and I'd go sit in a park, and I'd read every single word in the newspaper because I had nowhere else to go. I had nowhere to go, you know? It was before cell phones, so it wasn't like, oh yeah, I'll just call my buddy, you know? It was, it was a time where, you know, either I went to see my old friends that I knew got high, or, you know, there was really nothing for me. You know, I was afraid to go hang around the people that I knew because I knew they got high. Now, to back up a little bit, you know, I started drinking when I was 13. I started doing drugs when I was 15. I shot dope for the first time when I was 18 years old. The first night that I shot dope, I shot PCP. Which at the time we called Matchhead THC, you know, which, yeah, right. But what happened that night, January 1969, when I stuck my arm out and this guy stuck a syringe in it, I realized that I went from point A to point Z in a nanosecond, you know? And when I started getting high, I come from an alcoholic family, you know? My mother died down in Tucson at 47 years old. She rolled her car 6 times, broke her neck and back. Last time I saw her, she was in St. Mary's Hospital in a halo bed with her head screwed down with blood dripping out of her forehead, and the only way she could communicate with me was by blinking her eyes. And she was 47 years old, 6'2", beautiful, strapping woman who alcoholism had crushed, completely crushed. The last time I saw my stepfather down in Tucson, he was riding off with the Dirty Dozen. And I had a gun and he had a gun. And it was going to be either somebody's going to leave or somebody's going to get shot, you know? And the way I met my stepfather was I woke up on Christmas morning. My mother slept on the pull-out couch and my sister and I each had a bedroom. I woke up on Christmas morning to come out and open presents, and this man was in bed with my mom. And she had picked him up from Sing Sing, where he had just got done doing 3 to 5 for armed robbery. And she had met him by giving his mother rides to prison on visitation day. And so when he got out of jail, she figured he's better than a puppy. So she took him in, and he was this 5'10" bodybuilder, and I was this 6'5", 14-year-old, and he was going to teach me respect. You know, and he was a full-blown alcoholic, full-blown insane human being. And, you know, and he beat my ass for the next 3 years on a regular basis, you know. So I've seen alcoholism up close, you know. I've seen alcoholism up close every single day, you know. I come out of Greenwich Village in the 60s when there were juicers and heads, you know, and I was one of those heads. We used to drive around in a 59 Chevy and flash peace signs at people and think we were cool, you know, and take Osley and walk around the Fillmore in the West Village. And I was never going to be a juicer because I watched what alcohol did to my family, you know, and there's no way I was going to end up like my mother. You know, there's no way I was going to end up like the kind of person that my stepfather was. Now where all this is going, I have no idea. But, you know, so I started down this road of insanity at a very young age. You know, at a very young age. When you're shooting dope at 18 years old and you're living out on the streets, I left home at 17 and never went back. At 19 years old, I was snorting cocaine and heroin off of gold records with $100 bills, thinking everything my parents told me was a lie and this is what my life was going to be, because through circumstances and incidents beyond my control. I ended up working in the music business back in the early 70s and late 60s when stuff was just exploding, and I was in the right place at the right time, you know, and I hooked up with some people and life was crazy, and it was all about abundance and insanity, and we thought it was just normal, you know, it was normal, and that was the life I came out of, and that's the life I lived till about almost 1983, but full bore up until the late 70s. You know, it's funny because when I got here, I wasn't an alcoholic. I was just one of you guys. I was just a coke addict. You didn't understand. I was a coke addict. And I didn't realize that I carried a bottle of Kahlua in my suitcase everywhere I went. Because every morning when I would order coffee from room service, I made sure there was Kahlua in it, you know, to sweeten it up with some cream. And then it got to be, well, every morning there was some Kahlua and some vodka in the coffee, because it needed a kick to get me started, you know? And it never came to my mind that when we worked and we were out on the road, we had alcohol flow freely, but, you know, I only drank Heineken until 10 or 11 o'clock, so that doesn't make you an alcoholic if you're just smoking buds and drinking beer in the morning, you know? The alcoholics are the guys that are drinking Jack Daniels at 10 o'clock in the morning, you know? I never touch Jack Daniels till at least 2 or 3 in the afternoon, you know? I mean, that was a daytime drink, you know? And so like I said, you know, I got here under some really crazy circumstances. The first time I did cocaine, I injected it, you know? I remember I did it and I was strung out on black tar opium and I said, what's the big deal with this shit? You know, this doesn't do anything. It's like, okay, I got to overcome a big habit of black tar to feel cocaine. It's not going to happen. And then the magic happened. One guy showed up with a quarter ounce one night and said, here, do as much as you want. And my roommate and I went on a little shooting spree, you know. And it was back in the days where cocaine wasn't addictive, you know. So, you know, we started doing it, and come about 4 or 5 in the morning, I don't get, maybe not that late, but it was dark, it was late, and all of a sudden, you know, my roommate gets into that thing where, you know, it's time to turn off the stereo and the TV because he has to listen for them. And, you know, and then he starts doing the window thing. And I'm like, dude, what's going on here? And he says, look, there's a bush in the bush over there behind, you know. And I don't see anything because I don't get it yet, you know what I mean? But that yet part was really major. And, you know, it got to the point where it was so bad that the next day we went outside and there was one of the bushes were broken and he said, see, I told you there was a guy in this bush last night. And you would think from the first night of the insanity, because what happened, you know, we were being nice and we were taking turns. You know, okay, this is your shot, this is my shot. Somehow when there's two people doing it, somebody always gets the last hit. And it was me who was going to get the last hit. And we got into a fist fight on the floor because I took it and put it on the floor. And so you would think with the insanity of a fist fight with my roommate, paranoia beyond control, peeking out windows till, you know, the sun came up, trying to find a dealer at 5 o'clock in the morning to get more, you would think that might have been a clue that something was wrong. You know, because I'm a little hippie from Greenwich Village that thought taking acid and, you know, cruising around was it, you know, and here I am shooting Class A narcotics, peeking out of windows at 3 in the morning. And it wasn't. You know, I continued to shoot cocaine for probably almost 15 years, you know. And that was my preferred way of ingesting the drug. I thought smoking it was a total waste because I didn't need to get the curtains high. You know, I didn't get that part. It's like, what? You know? You know, and then it took all that time to do all that shit with the ether and the baking soda. And, you know, you guys now, I guess I have it easy. You just go down to the hood and you buy a macadamia nut and smoke it. But, you know. So, because I have so much time to kill, I'm going to just tell a couple of little more stories. And one is, you know, one of the nights when I knew I was really, really out there, and I had gone back to Atlanta from L.A., which is one of the places that I had spent some time, and I ran into an old friend of mine, and this old friend of mine was the first drug dealer I knew that made it. I mean, made it to like the 911 Porsche, to the house in the country, you know, made it. For 1976 or 77, he was living high on the hog. He had hefty bags full of cash buried in the woods and the whole deal. And he invited me over to his house to party, and he had an old country house, you know, out in the sticks. And he came out with a red wax ball and split it open with a big knife, and it was one giant Peruvian flake. And it kind of crumpled up on the table, and he had a box of syringes, and he said, man, do as much as you want, you know. So me being the rock and roll whore, I sat down at the table with a butter knife and did this shot and sat there and turned around and was like having a little thing. And he said, well, how was that? And I went, you know, in my arrogance, I went, well, it was good, but it wasn't quite what I was looking for. And he went, oh, well, go ahead, do some more if you want. So, you know, within about 30 seconds of already doing about a quarter of a gram, I dip a butter knife into this thing and do another hit, and it was a really hot hit, you know. And I turned around in my chair, and I put the syringe in the glass, and my hand starts going like this, and my feet start going like this, and I'm, like, twitching like crazy, and my eyeballs are switching, and I hear this clicky noise like in a silent movie where everything's just... And I look at my friend, and I go... Is this really happening or am I hallucinating? And he goes, no, this is really happening. And I'm like, you know, turning bright purple. So they take me into the next room, and there's an air conditioner in the wall and a rocking chair. And they put me in this rocking chair, and they wrap me in ice towels with ice in them. And I'm like dripping, and I'm sitting in this rocking chair holding on and going like this and, you know, getting up to about 100 miles an hour. And the old homes in Atlanta, maybe your grandmother's house, had flowery wallpaper, you know? So I'm watching all this wallpaper doing all this shit, like I had taken three hits of window pane or something, and I'm like going, holy shit. And I'm dripping with sweat, and then all of a sudden I realize that I'm getting tunnel vision. And the tunnel is starting to shrink, you know, and it's shrinking and it's shrinking and it's getting smaller. And it gets down to about the size of a 50-cent piece. And I'm sitting there just holding on, white-knuckled, in this chair, rocking out, staring at this little tiny spot on the wall, knowing in my heart that if I black out, I'm probably going to die. You know, if I black out, I'm probably going to die. And I sat there and I rode out that rush, and I got done, and I came out of it, and I walked into the other room, and my friends went, are you okay? And I went, yeah. And they say, well, what's going on? I said, I don't know, but let's do some more, because that was fucking great, you know? And that was 1976 or 77, and I continued to shoot dope through 1982. And every time I shot cocaine, I looked for that rush. You know, I looked for that grand mal seizure. And I can't tell you how many times I found it, and I was in the wrong room and remembered that I didn't lock the front door. And all of a sudden, I'm crawling on my hands and knees to check the security system, you know? Am I locked in, you know? And, you know, and in the end, it got to be complete insanity. You know, in the end, I started having stare-down contests with space people and shit, you know? And the worst part is that I had two kinds of space people. You know, I had the tall guys with hoods who had red eyes, and they never moved. They just stood on the other side of the window, really still. And I knew they were there, and I'd peek out at them and just watch. And then I'd think, well, it's time to go do another hit, but I don't want to leave yet, you know? And then I had the other kind of space people who were these little guys about this big, and they scampered, you know? They were the guys that, like, ran from chimney to chimney and bush to bush, you know? And I knew they weren't cops because they were too short. And I'd get really brave, I'd go back out on the porch, you know, I'd venture out into the air and, like, see if I could maybe catch one up close, you know, kind of like Munchkins or something. And, you know, one night I spoke at a lockdown VA unit in L.A., and a guy came up to me afterwards and went, man, I'm so glad you told that story. I thought I was the only guy that saw those little guys running around on the rooftops, you know? And, you know, in the end, when cocaine finally quit working for me, when I still had a little bit of shit going on down in Tucson, you know, I would go home at night, and at the time I was managing this biker strip joint down there that was about half the size of this room, and I would go home with a bunch of blow, and I'd lay out shots for the night, and I'd have a bucket of ice and a bucket of hot water, and I'd sit there, and I had my whole bar set, and I would just start shooting dope, you know, and I had a loaded 44 and a very sharp pencil, and I would do my shot. I would get fucking whacked out. I would get paranoid. I'd crawl into one room on my hands and knees. I'd take the pencil and I'd push aside the vertical blind and I'd lay on the floor and I'd just look out with the pencil because I knew if I used my finger, you guys could see my finger. But you couldn't see the pencil point. And then as soon as I thought that room was secure, then I'd go in the other bedroom and secure that room and then go into the living room and make sure that was secure. And as soon as my hands weren't shaking anymore, then I'd go do another hit, you know. Now, I worked at a strip club and offered dancers as much coke as they wanted to come home with me, and they wouldn't take me up on the offer. Something about a vision for you, I guess, you know? So I thought something was wrong with that picture. And, you know, and basically that led me up to where I told you, where I did this deal and stole this car and headed back to L.A., you know, and that was it. And when I got there, I had nothing, nowhere to go, nobody to see. I was scared to death. The people that I knew that lived in L.A. were in the entertainment business, and I knew they all got high. In the back of my mind, somewhere, I knew that getting high was part of my problem. I knew that drugs and alcohol had led to my downfall, but I wasn't quite sure how to connect the dots, you know? I wasn't quite sure how to make it work. And you know, I try to get a hold of a few friends. I would see a few people. I would hang out. I would try to find couches to crash on. And I was just literally bouncing around. I was 31 years old and didn't have anywhere to go. I'd blown every single opportunity in my life. I'd blown every single relationship in my life, you know. Although I did get married when I was using. That was exciting. I met this girl on a December on a job. We snorted coke. On January, we had our first date. She asked me if I knew how to shoot coke. I said, of course. 3 weeks later, I moved in because she was a bisexual coke addict who was into bondage. 4 months later, we got married, and it was quite the affair. And 4 months after that, we were divorced. But there was a lot of awake time in that 10-month period. You know? So I figure it was like about a 5-year marriage squeezed into about 10 months. But, so, I'm breaking things up here. So when I got back to L.A., obviously my ex-wife didn't want anything to do with me. Most of my friends didn't want anything to do with me. And I finally was able to get a hold of one man, you know, and who was a friend of mine, and we'd spend a lot of time partying and doing stuff and hanging out. And he said he would meet me for dinner. You know, and I went to this restaurant in L.A. and he met me there and he said, you know, another friend of mine is coming. His name is Charlie. And I was like, well, who's this guy? And he said, well, he's my sponsor. He goes, I've been in AA for a year and a half and I have 90 days sober. And Charlie showed up and they talked to me. And my memory being what it is, I can't tell you if they really 12-stepped me in the sense of trying to 12-step me into a meeting. But they just kind of talked to me about, you know, if you're really sick and tired of being sick and tired, and you really want to try to live life a different way, then maybe you might want to come to a meeting with us. You know? Just maybe. Now, CA at the time was about 3 weeks old. They had had the first meeting about 3 weeks earlier. And they said, well, we know where this new meeting is if you want to come with us tomorrow night. You know, and they took me to this meeting, which looked like this, but really wasn't like this. It was about a third of this room. And they sat me in the middle with two guys on either side who were absolutely spooky. And, you know, I'm living in my car with the stolen money. And this was in West Hollywood or Hollywood, right on the border. And I'm looking around the room counting Rolexes. And at the time, New Balance running shoes were in, and they were like $100 a pair. And my self-worth is diminishing by the second, you know, thinking, what am I doing here? And the speaker got up and he talked about making millions of dollars, losing millions of dollars, and now he was making millions of dollars again. And I'm thinking, fuck, man, what am I doing here? And, you know, and I had no idea what was going on. And then they opened the meeting up to participation, and this guy raised his hand, and he got up and he shared about going out on a relapse, and he talked about getting on his hands and knees and picking stucco out of the carpet. He talked about putting tinfoil on the bathroom window and poking holes in it, you know. Now, I related to this guy. My ears perked up because I understood everything he was talking about. I identified with every feeling that he was telling me. And then he said the one thing that changed my life forever. He said the reason he was back in a meeting was because he knew that this is where the hope was, you know. And at that moment, I don't know if I heard that for what it was, the fact that really what I wanted was just hope to have some kind of a life, hope to have a couch to sleep on besides the front seat of a Volkswagen, hope to maybe have a hot meal instead of a muffin from 7-Eleven. But it was appealing. It was appealing enough for me to make the decision to maybe stick around and try to go to one more meeting and meet some other people. You know, and I went up and introduced myself to this gentleman after the meeting, thinking he was some little Hollywood street urchin, you know, and we became friends, and he invited me up to his mansion in the hills for a party the next week, because he turned out to be some famous plastic surgeon, you know, and we still take cakes the same week every single year, you know, and he's not a guy that I would mix with, like it talks about in the book. I hang out with cops today, you know, I mean, it's weird. You know, one of my good friends is an ex-Detroit homicide cop who started out, you know, on the Vice Squad when they first started Vice. I mean, it's so bizarre who we end up hanging out with, you know. But what happened is the man came up to me after the meeting and said, "Do you have a copy of the Big Book?" You know, and this is the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I said, "No." And he said, "Here," he gave me my copy, and my friend said that as long as I was willing to go to meetings and stay sober, that I could sleep on his couch. And I ended up sleeping on his couch for 5 months. And this man, Tom, said to me, and for those of you who don't know, I'll say his name, Tom Kenny, Tom Kenny, Tom Kenny. Without Tom Kenny, there would be no Cocaine Anonymous. No matter what you read in HFC, what you hear from anybody, there would be no Cocaine Anonymous without Tom Kenny. It was his thought to create the first meeting. Anyway, Tom gave me my Big Book and said, "Take this back, read chapter 3, more about alcoholism. If you have any problems with the word alcohol, you substitute it for cocaine or cocaineism." You know, today it might be crack or crackism or Vicodin or Vicodinism, but whatever it is, it's the ism, you know? And that night I became an alcoholic. Because what happened is I started to read this book, and by the time I got through the second page of chapter 3, it described what my life was like and the insanity of my life. Now, I thought when I'm 31 years old, living in a stolen Volkswagen Rabbit, that I'd finally grown up to be the piece of shit that my stepfather always told me I was going to be. Something about that started to ring really clear in my head, you know? And what the book told me is that I suffered from a disease that was cunning, baffling, and powerful. And that if I chose, there was a possibility to recover from this disease, you know. And as I continued to read it, I continued to identify with all the insanity that the disease wreaks havoc on. Because I'm one of those guys who used to get plenty of fronts and had plenty of grand schemes and plenty of opportunities and plenty of ways that this time it was going to be different. That this time, if only, you know, I always thought my life was a case of bad breaks and misunderstandings, you know. I was always the victim. It was always something going on, if only, you know. What I come to find out was it was my bad choices, my lack of responsibility for every single thing I did because of the way the disease of alcoholism ran my life. Because the obsession to drink and use overwhelmed my desire to think clearly and live right, you know. And, you know, and by the time I got to the story about the jaywalker, I mean, that's it. You know, when you stick needles in your arms, you're like jaywalking with a locomotive, you know? Because I can't tell you how many times I've stuck a needle in my arm and woke up the next day hitting yellow jackets. If any of you guys remember what those were, they were barbiturates. We used to have these things, Nebutol, Secanols, Tuinols, before Quaaludes. And even for Quaaludes, some of those, you guys might not have caught some of those things, but Quaaludes were tough to shoot, a little milky. But I tried. I beat shit with hammers and cold soaked shit overnight to try to get it into a syringe. If you're a drug addict of my variety, you did whatever it took to get high, you know? And There's many a night that I OD'd and woke up and had grand mal seizures and swallowed my tongue and all sorts of crazy shit, you know? And if that's not jaywalking in front of the bus, I don't know what is, you know? So that chapter described the insanity of my disease of alcoholism to a T, you know? So no matter what, if you think you're an addict or you think you're a cocaine addict, you know, you probably are a person who suffers from the disease of alcoholism, which makes you an alcoholic, you know? You can play semantics about it, but, you know, the book I read says I'm an alcoholic who suffers from the disease of alcoholism. Maybe if they were crushing up coca leaves before they were crushing up grapes, we'd be talking about a different disease, but we're not right now. And the recovery that I know that Cocaine Anonymous practices comes from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is around here somewhere. You know, that's the basic text and the basic tools for recovery here. You know, the big book. And then once you've read the big book, there's this other book called the 12 and 12, which is pretty goddamn important. And I'll get to that later. But anyway, where was I? See, you get me on these rants about recovery. Shit.
12 and 12.
No, no Quaaludes.
12 and 12.
Somebody who doesn't know what a Roar 714 is, boy, I feel sorry for you. Gorilla Biscuits. Anyway, so I went to this meeting, and, you know, and this guy gave me this book, and I went and read it, you know, and what happened for me was that I got bit by the bug of enthusiasm that I talked about before. You know, I saw all this energy and all these people, and people were doing stuff. Now, I didn't have a whole lot of other places to go, so it was a good idea for me to go to meetings if I wanted to be sober. You know, I would go to 3 meetings a day, and I would hang out with anybody I could. I would go to coffee and fellowship afterwards with $5 in my pocket and spend my last $5 just to be a part of, you know. But the thing was is that I was staying sober, and I was going to meetings, and I was doing what I had to do, you know. And I was hearing a little bit more every day. You know, I would hear a little bit more every day. You know, when I got here, you know, there was a man who had talked about prayer. And he talked about how he was going down to face a federal judge and he was going to jail and he went in a men's room stall and he got on his knees to pray and this whole thing. And now this was the guy that was the millionaire that was the first speaker at my first meeting. And I'm thinking, this guy's in a stall in a men's room praying? What's this about? And I went up to Tom and I said, you know, what's the deal with prayer? You know, why is it so important? And we talked about it. And I said, well, I don't like the idea of getting on my knees to pray. You know, I don't want to get on my knees for nobody. And he said, well, if you got a problem with getting on your knees, he goes, at night, just take your shoes and throw them underneath the bed. And in the morning, when you're down there on your knees, just stop and say a prayer, you know. And that's the way I prayed for the first couple of times, you know. I would make believe. And if I would hear my friend coming from the back of the apartment, I would jump up so quick because there's just no way anybody was going to catch me on my knees. I'm a hip, cool rock and roller, you know. There's just no way. And, you know, and that's the way I started to pray. And I was still very uncomfortable with praying on my knees for a lot of years. And for those of you that don't know, we had a non-addict trustee in Cocaine Anonymous who was named Father Francis. And Father Francis is a Benedictine monk. And for any of you that may have even read HFC, which is another piece of literature that is suggested to read around here, there's something about going to meetings that, besides going to meetings, you read the literature. You know, it's in the literature. It's not in the meetings. You can go to meetings. You can stay sober on meetings. You will go insane and drink. You will go insane and drink or use if you only go to meetings. The solution is not in meetings. You know, you find out where the tools are in meetings, and you find out where your sponsor is in meetings, and you find out where your sponsor's friends are in meetings. Ah, enough preaching for a moment. Where was I? Oh, the monk. So if you've read HFC, there's a story where my friend Lionel picks up a bag out of cocaine out of his pocket and throws it up into the air in the wind and at the monastery. And so Father Francis was the first non-addict trustee, and I was up at the monastery one time visiting with Francis, and I said, you know, I am still having such a hard time with the idea of getting on my knees. He goes, man, I hate to pray on my knees. I said, you're kidding me. He goes, no, the only time I do that is when I'm in the chapel and I have to do it. He goes, to me, that's like Catholic aerobics, right, John? He's like, I hate it. He goes, when I wake up in the morning, he goes, I sit in my chair and I pray and I meditate. And it was like, whoosh, the this big weight off of me that, God, I don't have to be perfect in the eyes of God every time I try to pray. All I have to do is the best that I can do for the day that I can do it, you know? And that's the way that I opened up my heart to start to pray more, you know? And, and then I moved on into the other stuff, because when I first started to hear the steps, like most newcomers, it sounds like Chinese arithmetic, you know? It's like, what? You want what? Character defect, what? God as I understood, what? You know? And, and I heard the thing about inventory, and I was saying, you know, well, what's this about? And my sponsor said to me, he goes, you want a new life, you got to get rid of your old life. He goes, if you're living in an apartment and you got a bunch of old furniture, he goes, if you want to buy new furniture, you got to get rid of the old furniture. He goes, if you're making cider, if you're making moonshine in an old still, he goes, you got to clean that still out really good if you want to make cider in it, because the littlest bit of old residue, you're going to have fermented cider all over again. So you've got to do an inventory. So I thought, well, I'm going to write this great American rock and roll war story out, and it's going to turn into a screenplay. And, and I forgot to mention, when I got sober, I thought, well, if I stay sober long enough, in a year or so, I'll be a circuit speaker. I'll live back in the hills in Laurel Canyon. I'll have a Mercedes, another Harley Davidson, and I'll be working back in the music business. And on day 366, I was like, where's mine? My sponsor reminded me that I hadn't had a job yet for the first year. And I went, oh. But anyway, what he said to me is, no, he goes, you're not. He goes, you're going to take this inventory, you're going to make these columns, and you're going to write it like a telegram. You're going to go, da-da-da-da-da, stop. And you're going to go down, da-da-da-da, stop. And when you get done, you're going to go to the next column, and you're going to do it that way. And he goes, the only thing I want you to do is I want you to put, at the end, I want you to put the secrets in there that you were never going to tell anybody. You know, and I did that. When I sat down and I shared that inventory and did that fifth step, that was the first time as an adult that I'd ever been completely honest to the best of my ability with another human being, you know? And the freedom that was there for me was unbelievable. Now, if you read the big book on page 77, you guys hear all the time about the promises, and we read them from the podium. The first set of promises on page 77, where it talks about the fifth step being the bridge, the beginning of the bridge back to life, the beginning of the spiritual experience, where the path broadens, you know? That's the fifth step. It's the first set of promises when you go through the book, you know. And for me, it was the beginning of that freedom to allow me to become who I am. Because for years, I was a hustler, a liar, a cheat, a con artist, you know. I remember I was at a party for a band in L.A. one night, and I knew all the guys in the band, and I was walking around, and I had one of those brown bottles with square bottoms on it, you know, that they talk about in Who's an Addict, and a bottle of Dom under my arm, and I was working the room. And I was hustling, and I looked over, and the keyboard was staring at me. The keyboard player was staring at me, shaking his head, going, still the same. Because he knew. He knew I was just scamming on everything in the room, you know, that there was nothing really going on. It was just one big hustle. You know, and today I can get that same feeling back of how he expressed that to me, because I knew that I was so full of shit, you know. And I wanted to do that inventory. I think I did my first inventory when I had about 79, 89 days, something like that, you know, and I wanted to get it out. I wanted to start to clean up and to start the process of recovery. It says in the book, when you read chapter 5 and it goes ABCs, it says we immediately set upon a course of action of taking an inventory. It doesn't say we wait till we have 4 months, because in the fourth month we should take the fourth step. It doesn't say we should wait till we have 4 years, because in the fourth year we should take the fourth step. It doesn't say wait till your sponsor tells you you're well enough to do it. You know, it doesn't say we wait till you think you're well enough to do it, because in that case, we never do it. It says we immediately set upon a course of action, you know, and that's what it is, you know. And, and Bill Wilson in his later years in his writing said that the two biggest keys to long-term sobriety is inventory and meditation. You know, Bob said love and service before he died, and before Bill died, he said meditation and inventory. The two biggest things for long-term sobriety. Now, I've been coming to this room for a long time, and there might be three people that I know in here that probably have over 15 years. You know, now I know there's still, some of them are still around, but, you know, a week ago, a girl with 8 years that I know committed suicide. In my last 5 years, I've probably seen, actually, more people than I can count OD, die, and go out and use, you know, because they held on to their secrets. Because they held on to their character defects, you know. And another thing we'll go into, When you read the book on the sixth and seventh step, there's two paragraphs on six and seven in the big book. So if your sponsor's taking you through six and seven in the big book, say, please, can we do it in the 12 and 12? Because in the 12 and 12, there's 43 paragraphs on 6 and 7, written less than 10 years after the big book was written. So maybe Bill had a clue that he was missing out on something in 1938 when he started to write the book. Maybe he had a clue that there is a little more to character defects and to humility. Because the 7th step is completely about humility. You know, and when you read further, it talks about that the entire purpose of each step is for us to gain more humility to become closer to God. You know, now when I did when I did 6 and 7 the first time, I thought I said the 7-step prayer. I thought God was going to come down, open my head with an ice cream scoop, take every character defect out, and fly away, and I was going to be like saintly. I thought the white light was going to hit me, and I was going to walk around like, you know, with this spiritual arrogance, just thinking I had it down, you know? And I was still stealing, I was still lying, I was still cheating, I was still hustling, I was still working rooms like they were bars. You know, character defects didn't go away. What Bill wrote in the 12th step is that each day we pray for our character defects based on the causes and conditions of the day that we pray. That every single day we pray for our character defects based on the causes and conditions of the day that we pray. What that means to me is that every day when I get up to say my prayers and I want to say my prayers about my character defects, I have to verbalize consciously what character defects have risen up in me and which character defects are bothering me at the moment, which ones I seem to be acting out on the most, you know, because they sneak up on you and they bite your ass. And I've seen more people go out and get loaded over untreated alcoholism, which is basically character defects, than anything else. You know, thinking that they have to be part of the game, that they have to be cool, that they have to be part of, they have to be better than, they have to be anything. Or it's the opposite, where they're afraid and they feel less than, they don't feel good enough, they don't feel like they can be a part of, you know. They don't feel loved. The only way to overcome that stuff is to do the steps. It's the only way. It's not going to happen through osmosis, and it's not going to happen by sitting in a folding metal chair. You know, I've had great experiences in my life. You know, I've gotten to speak around the world. You know, I have friends in London. I go to Costa Rica every year. Scott came to Costa Rica with me a couple of years ago and had a great time when we were down there at the AA convention. You know, I mean, life is incredible when you stay sober. Now, remember, I never made this decision to get sober. You know, I showed up thinking, what am I doing? What am I going to do? And I've been given this life that's unlike anything I've ever known. You know, I've had opportunities that have just been fantastic. You know, and just because I'm saying that everything is great doesn't mean that I, like, started to do all this work and became a spiritual giant. You know, I've been arrested 3 times in sobriety. You know, I've had umpteen broken relationships in sobriety. I've had umpteen career choices in sobriety. You know, it's a learning process. You know, I have to understand who I am. What I've come to realize is that the more I know about my disease, the more I know about my recovery. Because when I understand what my disease is and how my disease works in me, the more I understand how to deal with the disease and how to deal with me. You know, I am who I am with my character defects. I can't be Terry, I can't be John, I can't be Kevin, I can't be anybody else. I can only be the best me that I can be today. And who I am is an emergence of a lifetime of experiences that have created me. And thank God now that I have 21 years of sober experiences that are a big part of me, so I have sober experiences to draw on. But I still have an alcoholic childhood. I still have victimization as a kid. I still have stuff that gets set off. I still have abandonment issues. I still have stuff that goes on that has to be dealt with, that all gets touched on either through relationships with people or places or work or whatever that comes up. You know, it's like we talk about the different layers of an onion. Stuff just starts to happen and it starts to come up and you have to deal with it. You know, my friend Danny likes to say issues, you know, and he goes, there are no issues. You know, there's just character defects, period, you know. And he goes, there's no fucking issues around here. You know, pop psychology and stuff like that came around the same time that that AA kind of exploded in the early 80s, so there was a lot of codependency, in other words, that were banged around into recovery and into the babble of AA, which really are out of place, you know. And you know, I've had the opportunity to go to Akron, you know, to go to Dr. Bob's house and to see what happened up there. You know, I went in there and met this old lady and this old guy, and they took us on a tour of the house, and we went upstairs into the room where they have the jewelry cases set up with the Emmett Fox books and pictures of Group Number One on the wall. And then they ask if you want to see a video, and they show you a video of Bill and Bob meeting with these shadowy figures, but they use the real Mayflower lobby, and they use the real guest house, and they do the whole thing. And, you know, by the time that movie was over and I'm walking back down the stairs to the living room, I just start crying, you know, and the little old lady comes up to me and pats me on the back, and she goes, "It's okay, honey, it happens to a lot of people." And I'm like, oh, you know, and, you know, and then they take you down in the basement to buy the Dr. Bob t-shirts and the Dr. Bob ashtrays and coffee cups and the unedited version of the Big Book, which if you think the Big Book edited was really poorly written, you should read the unedited version. And, you know, and I was standing down in the basement, and there was this bushel basket, a couple of them actually, off to the side, and they were full of chunks of stuff. And I said to the lady, "Well, what's that stuff?" And she goes, "Well, we had a problem with dry rot on the back porch, so we ripped out the whole back porch and the foundation from the porch." And I went, "So you mean that's foundation from Dr. Bob's house?" She goes, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, can I have some?" And she looks at me like I'm crazy and says, "Yeah, I guess." So I'm like loading my pockets with these pieces of mortar and stuff, you know, and thinking, I got Dr. Bob's house. And, you know, and it was one of the great experiences of my life. When I spoke at that banquet that night, I cried like a baby because I was so touched by the experience. And sitting on my dresser at home, I still have one piece left that's this big, because over the years I've broken it up and given away as birthday presents to people, you know. And I touch it, you know, I pick it up and touch it and think about what it is and what it means, you know. And you know, life is a miracle. You know, they asked Scott Peck, the guy that wrote The Road Less Traveled, if any of you read it, what he thought was the greatest event of the 20th century. And he said, without blinking an eye, the founding of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that it was the most powerful thing that's happened to society in the last 1,000 years. You know, and we're a part of that recovery. We're a part of that process, you know. Each of us has his own path to find in here. And you know, this is what we get to do. You know, do I say it or don't? A little over 2 years ago, I died. You know, I died. I had just had brain surgery. I was in a ICU and I crashed. You know, and I had an out-of-body experience. I was on the ceiling, looking down, as they called this code on me, and the head doctor was from Chicago because he had a Chicago accent, and I remember it as clear as if he was standing entire time I was in there. And I struggled really intensely while I was in there. And I started to talk to him about it, and he said, "How did you know what happened?" And I said, "Because I saw the whole thing, you know." And you know, and I thought I was a good little AA-er. I was 18, 19 years sober at the time. You know, I thought I had some stuff down. I thought I was accepting. I thought I understood what God's will was for me, you know. And then I started having these dizzy spells. And then I went to the doctor, and they had pictures of my head taken. And I walked in the doctor's office, and he went, "Well, you have a brain tumor the size of a walnut growing on your brain stem, and you need to have surgery right away." And I was like, "Huh?" And he said it again, and I'm like, this is like a bad TV movie happening to me, you know. And then my neurologist's office was next to my GP, and my GP's sober about 14 years, and I went over to him, and he has a desk like this, and on that side of the desk are two chairs, and I sat in one of the chairs, and for the first time in 14 years, he got up and he walked around the desk and sat in the chair next to me and said, "It's going to be okay." And scared the shit out of me. And, you know, they talked about getting me in to see the number one brain surgeon in the world, and they were going to try to make an appointment for me to do this. And I realized, you know what, these guys aren't fucking around. They're serious. And I was consumed with terror. Consumed with terror. And you know what kicked in? Pick up the phone and start calling. Because before I was out of the parking garage, I was on the phone with my first sponsor, my current sponsor, my best friend. I mean, I was calling everybody and nobody was home. You know, and like I said, you guys are lucky. You've got cell phones as a tool. When I got sober, they told me to always carry a roll of dimes in your pocket. Because that's back when phone calls were 20 cents. So, you know, always have a roll of dimes. You know, and I had this. And the other thing I was told for you newcomers is that one of the greatest tools going is when you go to a meeting, you get two phone numbers of people with less time and two phone numbers of people with more time. And the next day you call those four people. And then the next day you call those eight people. And the next day, you know what? And I spent a lot of time calling people. And when I had problems, I had a support group and a network of people of both less time and more time. And when I went through this situation, you know, my sponsor called me back in a few minutes and he goes, I'll be there in an hour and I'm taking you to a meeting. And that's what he did. And we went to a meeting, you know. And my sponsor was the kind of man, you know, I met my sponsor at a men's stag, and Brendan knows my sponsor. And my sponsor has Parkinson's disease and he shakes like a motherfucker. You don't want to be sitting next to him when he's eating super spaghetti because you're wearing it. And I take him to the movie sometimes and I have to be the buffer between him and the other people in the movies because he kicks me the whole movie and I'm like, fuck, man. And it's really bad when he sits behind me and puts his feet on my chair and the whole night I'm like this. You know, and I had met this guy and I was thinking, man, he's such an interesting man. And when I met him, he had about 26 or 27 years. And I thought, you know, why is this man all of a sudden in my life? And, you know, he suffers from a neurological disorder. And what he's learned in the 10 years that he's had Parkinson's disease is acceptance. And you know what he said to me? He goes, I can have Parkinson's disease with a good attitude, or I can have Parkinson's disease with a bad attitude. He goes, you can fall off a 10-story building, you can scream and kick the whole way down, or you can just relax and enjoy the ride, you know? And let me tell you, as silly as that sounds, it kind of relieved some of the pressure because I knew that everything was out of my control, you know? And what ended up happening is he actually took me to a men's stag that Sunday night because this happened on a Thursday, and I was telling him how the doctors were trying to get me to see this doctor and we couldn't get an appointment for months, and they wanted to operate right away. And I was telling a friend of mine that's sober a long time, and we were sitting there talking, and the next day my friend called me up and said, was the doctor you were talking about a Dr. Black? And I went, yeah. And he goes, did you meet the newcomer sitting next to me, Pierre, on the couch? And I went, no. And he said, well, Pierre went to school with Dr. Black. He said, he can get you an appointment. Now, my own two doctors couldn't get me an appointment with this guy, right? And so it happened that in the next couple of days, I was able to go see one of his assistants, associate doctors. And I had walked in, I walked up the reception window, checked in, my phone rang, and it was Pierre. And he says, are you still trying to see Dr. Black? And I said, I'm standing in the office right now. And he goes, well, go sit down. And I sat down. This lady came out from the back and said, Mr. Cross. And I went, yeah. She goes, well, I talked to Pierre. I just hung up with Dr. Black in New York. The other doctor's going to see you, and then they're going to talk. And I went in and saw the guy. They took the pictures of my brain and put them all over the wall and pointed at him with fingers and did this. And I'm like freaking out, and the doctor excused himself. And then he came back in the room and he said, Dr. Black's coming back from New York on Sunday. He's going to see you on Tuesday. He's going to operate on you two weeks from today. Now, this is the number one brain surgeon in the world, who's been on the cover of Time magazine and on 60 Minutes and testified before Congress. And, I mean, there's a line out the door to even get this guy just to talk to, you know. And this newcomer, with less than 30 days, was able to get me in to see this doctor. Now, I underwent the surgery and had all these problems, and it took me quite a few months before I was able to get back out. And I'd got back out, and I went to one of my nighttime meetings, and my friend came in that had helped me hook up with Pierre, and he said to me, did you hear about Pierre? And I went, what? He goes, he OD'd and died last night. Now, why shit happens like this? I don't know. Why is God's grace in my life? I don't know. Why is Pierre not able to stay sober after years of coming around and relapsing? This is a guy with Ferraris, Lamborghinis, and mansions in the hills. Couldn't get sober. You know? Why does God work in our life one way and somebody else's life another way? I don't know. What I know is that I show up and I just try to be the best me that I can be, try to do the next right indicated thing, and not hurt anybody else. And when I do that, my life is full of God's grace. Full of God's grace. Doesn't happen for me sitting in metal chairs. It doesn't happen for me just showing up. It happens for me being a part of the whole package deal. Unity, service, and recovery. I've had commitments from the week I got sober. To this day, I am still secretary of a meeting, I'm still treasurer of a meeting, and I'm a World Service trustee. I do shit that I do not want to do, but I do it anyway because it's what kept me sober for 21 years. I still sponsor people. I still have guys that want to come over the house and read the 12-12, and don't you know the Yankees game is on? Leave me alone. You know, and they come over and they take me to dinner and we go through the book and I read my underlined parts of the book for the millionth time, you know, but that's what I've been told to do for me to stay sober. You know, when I get asked to do something, I show up to do it, no matter how I feel about it, you know, and that's how simple it is. You know, I didn't get here. When I got here, I wasn't given any magic tools. You know, I didn't plan on getting sober. It wasn't my great decision to wake up and say, this is it, I'm going to be drug-free and alcohol-free for the rest of my life. You know, I was looking for a job and a meal and a couch to sleep on. And a guy gave me a big book and a meeting directory and told me what to do. You know, he didn't like give me a green book and say, forget the blue one, we give the blue one to the losers. He didn't give me like a secret meeting directory and say, forget about those meetings, this is where the winners go. I got the exact same stuff that every newcomer has when he comes in here, you know? And the keys, as I was told, are honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, you know? And today, because I haven't worked in 2.5 years and probably won't ever again, which is fine by me, I get to go to 5 and 10 meetings a week. I get to sponsor more guys than I've ever sponsored. I get to have commitments. You know, I get to go to a lot of recovery-oriented events. My sponsor has this great line. He goes, you know, you learn to ride a bicycle, you ride a bicycle for life. You learn to swim, you learn to swim for life. You go to AA, it's good for about a week and a half. You know? So you got to keep coming to keep hearing the message. You got to keep coming to keep hearing the message, you know? And, you know, your life can be full of grace. You know, I have an incredible life. I live on the beach, you know? I play golf a couple of times a week with my friends. I ride my motorcycle up and down the Pacific Coast Highway. You know, I hang out with people that love me and that I love. You know, life is fantastic, you know. It's absolutely fantastic. And there's times where I think I wish I had my job at the movie studio with my own parking spot and was hip, cool, and slick and all this other stuff, you know, because I thought I had arrived. You know, but what my sponsor likes to remind me is you have a job. Your job is to carry the message, you know, carry the message to people who need to hear what recovery is about, you know. And the opportunities are endless. You know, your life can be the fullest, richest, most loving thing you've ever experienced. You know, absolutely. I have friends in Phoenix that I've had for 18 years. You know, 18 years I've had relationships with people in this town that truly I love and that love me. You know, and I have that all over the world. All over the world I have those kind of relationships. When I got here, my sister wouldn't spit on my grave. You know what I mean? And my life is full. My life is full because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the principles that are put forth, you know? And all I can wish for you guys is that you guys find the same kind of grace in your lives that I was able to find in mine through working the steps and working with others, you know? And treat this program with respect. You know, treat this program with respect. You never know when the person that you're heckling at the podium might be the person who saves your life. You never know when the one thing you need to hear being read is being read from the podium. The podium is sacred ground, you know. This is where recovery starts for a lot of newcomers, because this is where they get to hear the message. You know, this is a special, special place. Alcoholics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, any of it, you know, and treat it with the reverence and respect that it deserves, because it'll save your life. You know, they said the great fact for us, one of the great facts is that 9 out of 10 of us will be dead or using probably in the next 10 years. You know, I've seen it. In 21 years, I have seen it. And it doesn't have to be that way. You know, honesty, open-mindedness and willingness. You know, jump in with all the enthusiasm you can. Learn everything you can. Meet everybody you can meet. Get a home group and get connected. You know, life is full of love and you're there. You can be the miracle that you want to be. Thanks.